I'd like to call this meeting of the House State Affairs Committee to order. The time is 3:17 on Saturday, February 21st, 2026, and we're here in room 120. Please silence cell phones today. Members present include Representative St. Clair, Representative McCabe, Representative Vance. Representative Holland may be joining us telephonically. I don't see him yet, however. Representative Himshue.
Hi, I'm in there.
Okay. Representative Holland is here. Representative Himshue and myself, Chair Carrick, let the record reflect we have a quorum to conduct business. Our record secretary today is Cecilia Miller, and our moderator from the Juno LIO is Renzo Moises, and our committee aide today is my staff, Stuart Relay. Thank you all for being here on a Saturday.
Sunny Saturday.
We have four items on today's agenda. We start with a first hearing on House Joint Resolution 22 on federal term limits from Representative Tomaszewski. We then have House Joint Resolution 23 on a constitutional amendment relating to the governor's budget by Representative Underwood. And then two related items, House Bill 290 and House Concurrent Resolution 10, both on distribution of resolutions from Representative Holland's office. I'd also like the record to reflect we've just been joined by Vice Chair Story. The first item on the agenda today is House Joint Resolution 22 from Representative Tomaszewski relating to federal term limits. This is our first hearing on this resolution. Today we'll have an introduction and presentation from the sponsor's office. We have invited testimony from U.S. term limits and then public testimony also today. So with that, I'd like to welcome Representative Tomaszewski to put your name on the record and begin your presentation.
Thank you, Chair Carrick and the State Affairs Committee for being here on a Saturday. For the record, my name is Representative Frank Tomaszewski, represent Northeast and South Fairbanks, kind of a big district. But I just appreciate the committee coming in on Saturday to hear this resolution. And without further ado, I'll just get right into it. House Joint Resolution 22 is a federal constitutional convention for term limits. This is a resolution requesting the United States Congress to propose an amendment to the Constitution of the United States to set a limit of terms that a person may be elected as a member of the U.S. House and Senate, and to call for a constitutional convention of the states to propose a single amendment to the Constitution of the United States to set on that number of terms that a person may be elected as a member of the United States House and Senate. At the request of U.S. term limits, I am bringing forth this resolution. In a poll from January the 2nd through the 8th of 2025, 84% of respondents in Alaska favored term limits. If we want fresh ideas and younger legislators, this will create the opportunities to do so. Currently, 12 states have passed similar resolutions for term limits, and 14 other states have legislation in committee. It takes 34 states to bypass Congress to call a convention to propose a congressional term limits amendment. What we must realize is that a third of our U.S. Senate is over 70 years old, including eight members who were born prior to World War II. Over the last 20 years, the U.S. House incumbents have a 94% reelection rate. The Senate numbers are not much better. The last cycle, 100% of Senate incumbents were reelected. It is time to change the way things are done in Washington and send a clear message that not only Alaska, the United States wants U.S. term limits. With that, Chair Carrick, I'm going to have my staff, Connor Mariner, come up along with Constantine Carrard and give the presentation on U.S. term limits.
Great. Thank you very much. And we'll welcome Mr. Constantine, I'm going to say your last name wrong. I apologize. Quirad and Connor Mariner, staff to Rep. Tomaszewski, if both of you can put your name on the record. And if we go back and forth between presenters, just make sure to restate your name, just because it'll help make the record nice and clear. And please go ahead with your presentation.
Yeah, for the record, Connor Mariner, I'm staff to Representative Frank Tomaszewski.
Constantine Carrard, very close, with U.S. Terminates.
Okay, for the record, Connor Mariner, staff to Representative Frank Tomaszewski. What is HDR 22? As the representative already iterated, HDR 22 is a single topic resolution that requests U.S. Congress to propose a congressional term limits amendment. The states have the power to do this under Article 5 of the U.S. Constitution. Why is there a need for U.S. term limits? Well, among the multitude of reasons, it kind of falls on three main pillars: to restore a citizen legislature, to bring state-specific experience to D.C., and bring private sector experience to D.C. Diving a bit more in depth on what restoring a citizen legislature means and looks like, right now most states are governed by citizen legislators who serve part-time and live in small districts. Because of this, state legislative races generally have lower barriers to entry because challengers don't need a massive campaign war chest to run a successful or effective campaign. Term limits in Congress would generate open seat races, which results in fewer barriers to entry. As a result, this lessens federal lawmakers' reliance on special interests and maintains closeness and accountability with their constituents. Bringing state experience to D.C. is important. States were intended to be laboratories of innovation, and for the most part, we consistently deliver on that premise. However, oftentimes, stagnation in Washington prevents the state's best and most creative ideas being prevented at the federal level. And stagnation results in a lack of innovation. Term limits provide a gateway to bring new ideas to Washington. Private sector experience, very similar to the previous side. At the federal level, there is very little pathway for an individual private sector success to serve meaningfully in Congress without fully abandoning their private career, because it takes years, if not decades, to actually have any sway in Congress, so nothing new gets done. Therefore, Congress has become a place for individuals who mainly rely on their political experience instead of successful professionals choosing to run. With term limits, industrious people could run and serve for a short time, which brings diversity and experience to a body which lacks it. The support for HDR 22 is widespread across Alaska and the nation. Currently, 84% of Alaskans support implementing U.S. term limits, with the national average for support pulling around 80%. There is no other issue that enjoys such a wide level of support across party lines. As of today, there are 12 states that have passed calls for term limit amendment, with 16 states that already have term limit sets in their state statutes, and 14 states currently have similar legislation in their political spheres. Are there any questions?
Great. I'm looking around. I see a couple questions. Representative St. Clair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the chair, a quick question. How long are these resolutions good for? Either one of you.
Madam Chair and Representative Constantine Carrard with the U.S. term limits, they basically would last in perpetuity. States can rescind them if they wish to, but they generally last because you don't know how long it'll take to get to where enough states put pressure on Congress to do it. There are states that have historically – there are some that have put time limits like, okay, but in 20 years this goes away if it hasn't happened by then. So that's always an option. But generally states that want it done, and so they don't necessarily want to put a limit – on when it gets done. They just want it done.
Okay, thank you.
Vice Chair Story is next in the queue.
Yes, thank you, Chair Carrick. Thank you. I had a question someone had posed to me, and that was when you call the convention to open the Constitution, can you take up other things, or is this just limited to congressional term limits?
Yeah, thank you, Rep. Sawyer, for the great question. Through the chair, No, you cannot open up the entire Constitution. It is a single item resolution that they can only propose an amendment for that specific topic.
Thank you.
I think I have a follow-up to just on that point. Because this is a resolution to Congress, what would prevent Congress from not doing a single item? In other words, the resolution from the states would call for a single item constitutional convention, but what prevents that from actually, what prevents that from not becoming a more open discussion?
Once again, thank you, Rep. Carrick, for the great question. Through the chair, in theory, what happens is if 34 states pass resolutions, a delegation is called. Each state sends delegates for a proposed amendment to the Constitution. Once the proposed amendment is finished, the states have to ratify that amendment. So it's a system of checks and balances, which prevents exactly what your question was from happening.
Okay, thank you. Representative Himshute?
Thank you. Through the chair, in other democracies, are there term limits? And I mean congressional, like at their parliamentary level, and, you know, yeah. I suppose House of Lords, probably not, but... Like if you have a parliamentary system or whatever other systems are out there, are there term limits for the people's representatives?
Yeah, Madam Chair and Representative Judd, it's a great question. I know the answer is yes, but I don't know the list of them. So I will get that and send it to your office so you can have it.
Thank you. And just to point out, it's page 2, line 14, call a convention limited to proposing an amendment to the United States Constitution. So that, I think that's what we're getting at is this one thing. Okay, thank you.
Do we have additional questions for the sponsor staff or invited testimony? Seeing none, I just also want to recognize that Representatives Underwood and Costello have joined us today. Thank you so much for being here. At this time, if folks do have questions, we can open it up for more questions after we open public testimony. We are going to open public testimony on House Joint Resolution 22 at this time. And I see one person online for public testimony. Do we have anyone in the room for public testimony first? Seeing none. Would you like to provide public testimony? Okay.
Please,
please, Mr. Going to avoid saying your last name so I don't say it wrong. Courard.
Perfect, actually.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, thank you, Chair Carrick and members of the committee. My name is Constantine Courard. I am the Western Regional Director for U.S. Term Limits. And on behalf of the tens of thousands of Alaskans who are kind of signed up for the cause, I'm grateful for the chance to speak. Representative Tomaszewski and Connor did a good job in terms of like why we need term limits. There are probably 20 more great reasons, which time permitting, we could – everybody sort of has their own reasons. And that's kind of what makes the issue so remarkable is that – virtually everyone seems to support it, even though they all have a lot of different reasons for it. And the support is extraordinary because you get people who really can't agree on much of anything who will agree on this. So you could have President Obama and President Trump saying yes. You could have Ted Cruz and Beto O'Rourke, and they're both, yes, we need term limits on Congress. You have Nick Begich and Mary Peltola who are like, yes, we need term limits. I think Representative Peltola tweeted on it a couple of weeks ago about like, we need term limits on Congress. So people who don't really aren't known for agreeing on a lot of things all come back to this one thing and they're all like, yes, we need this done. And I think people understand why Congress is obviously a fairly dysfunctional institution, but they can be because they know they're all going to win anyway. They have this sense of invulnerability because they're going to get reelected as a matter of course. And what I see in a lot of states, and I'd lean into your Alaska experience to confirm whether it's the same here, but incumbents who have been in office for a long time begin to lean into seniority as the selling point. Like you need me there. It doesn't matter if you like me. It doesn't matter if you agree with me. It doesn't matter if we have the same vision for our country or our state. You need me there because I've been there for a long time. And so because I've been there for a long time, you have to stick with me until I basically die or quit. I don't know if that's a thing in Alaska the way it is in a lot of other states, but it's pretty common in states where you have folks that have been there 15, 20 years because by the time they hit 18, 20 years, they're starting to get influence. when you're there 2 years, 4 years, 6 years, you're just junior. You don't really have the influence. But once you've been there for 18, 20 years, they're like, well, hey, it's just getting good now. You can't quit on me now. You're stuck with me. And that is a system that, frankly, everyone should want to take down with sledgehammers, because what is this free will that we imagine the voters have if – again, if I walk you into a restaurant with one thing on the menu and say, order anything you want, that's not really how the system is supposed to work. So a lot of reasons. Again, it is something that has very broad support. I appreciate our sponsors are – I mean, here we have R's, D's, I's, majority, minority. I think everybody's got someone on the team on this one. I appreciate the questions. I'm going to send some detailed answers to a couple of the questions we had, so I don't take your time here. But I do stand for questions if anybody has any additional ones.
Thank you very much for testifying. And I think because you are also invited testimony, we will open it up for questions after we finish taking public testimony. Seeing no one else in the room to testify, we do have one online testifier, and I'd like to call on Ed Martin.
Well, thank you, Chair, House State Affairs. This is a very good subject for state affairs. I believe we need it in our state also, but I do support this resolution for a lot of reasons. As 71 years old, come Monday, I voted in many elections from 73 on, and a lot of those, in fact, that one in particular was Don Young, and he stayed virtually his whole career and his life. There's a downdraw on this whole thing that I think a lot of people don't realize. It's called the war chest, and it's a campaign reelection war chest that goes on and on and on. My feelings is this. We have too many people that have made this a career, and not for all the right reasons. Their oath is subject to their egos instead of the oath that's subject to the people. So I hope this is a good statement to make as a man that's over 70 with a little wisdom. So I do hope and appreciate that you pass this resolution on to Congress. And oh, by the way, there's other bills coming up that we'll speak about and resolutions, and just hand it to our congressional delegation and tell them to do their job. Okay? Thank you very much for the opportunity to speak on this resolution 22.
Thank you, Mr. Martin. And that concludes public testimony. I see no one else online or in the room to testify, so we are going to close public testimony on House Joint Resolution 22. And that brings the resolution back before us. Representative Himshu, did you have a question?
I do. Thank you, Chair Carrick. I already mentioned to the sponsor of the resolution that I haven't come to terms with term limits, was what I said earlier. And my issue has to do with, I come from a rural part of our state, and the only way that we really get a say, if you need more snow plowing in Anchorage, you've got 20 legislators fighting for that snow plowing. You need better ferries in the Southeast, and you have a handful of people working on it. So I have reservations about term limits in that way. The way to get a little more say in what happens is through that seniority system. And so maybe that seniority system can still be capped and limited. And let's say nobody serves more than 12 years, and you get to years 10, 11, and 12 as a rural Alaskan, and you do have that say. And so maybe it's fine, but that is a reservation that I have, is rural folks. And I'm talking more at our level, at the legislature, but this is something that I think about a lot on this topic, is we have to do something crazy, like join a caucus that we're not necessarily aligned with, or we have to be there a long time to be able to really get anything done for our people. So that's a reservation I have. I don't know if you have thoughts on that.
I do, Representative, again, Constantine Carrard with U.S. Term Limits, and Madam Chair and Representative Himshute. So the concern is dead on correct. It's the right one to have, particularly when you're in a state that has a small delegation like Alaska does. You also kind of saw to the end of how it actually would work out. The the magic time you had with Young and Stevens, where they were both in office for so long, and you happen to have like the number one guy here and the number one guy there, statistically speaking, that's just never going to happen again. That's not a good strategy. So how do you deal with the seniority question? You are correct. Let's say 12 years is the limit. By the time you've been there 7 or 8 years, your delegation has seniority. Now, so do a lot of other states, because again, if we're capping everybody at 12, there's presumably a number of people that are at year 7 or 8. And so what we've seen in states that have term limits is that subject matter expertise starts to matter more than seniority. There is seniority, because obviously if you're there 2, 3, 4 years, you're not a committee chairman, you're not a subcommittee chairman, but you do start to collect that influence as you get to, let's say, years 5, 6, 7, 8. But then subject matter expertise starts to matter for more. In Congress, you might have Chuck Grassley say, hey, I want to run healthcare because I want to raise pharma dollars. But Chuck Grassley doesn't understand healthcare, and I've got a doctor running ag because Grassley took healthcare. And the doctor doesn't know ag any better than Grassley knows healthcare, and the staff runs them both, and the whole system's kind of a hot mess. In states that have term limits, you will find educators on the education committee and people that have medical experience on the healthcare committee because subject matter expertise. So that's good for a state like Alaska because you're likely to send representatives who have expertise in the things that matter to Alaska. So what happens right now is Representative Begich is in his first term. And if you want to wait 24, 28 years for him to have real juice, you could do that. But that's not a great plan when it's 28 years away. You could conversely be in a situation where everybody's going to have some juice for a while. In other words, you'll have juice more frequently for shorter durations. Let's say 12 years is the answer. Yeah, by the time you get to 9, 10, 11, 12, someone in your three-person delegation, maybe two of them, are going to have some juice for a period of 3, 4 years before the clock starts again. So you'll be in and out of that position of greater influence on a more frequent basis, but you'll have three shots at it. And their influence is likely to be felt where they have subject matter expertise as opposed to just a straight seniority system where whoever's been there longest picks the committee they want. So the concern is valid, but you also kind of had the how it works portion correct as well.
Quick follow-up.
Thank
you for that. I appreciate it. And through the chair, I guess, I don't disagree with what you're saying, but the subject matter expertise, I feel a flaw in our system here in our state is the lack of expertise because our committee staff are partisan and they go with their legislator. So at the federal level, I believe you have professional committee staff. So they have that both expertise and longevity. Oh, this was tried back in this year and here's what happened. I don't know that even in the areas where I'm supposed to have some expertise. I don't know what was tried 10 years ago. I was out in a classroom teaching and there might've been a headline and I read the first paragraph, but I didn't go deep. And so that power and influence resting in staff is not necessarily misguided. So that's another hesitation I have is the idea that we don't want to let staff have too much influence. Part of me feels like, yes, we do. So anyway, thank you for the, I don't know that I have a question in that. I just really appreciate the conversation and I will try to come to terms.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative. And I didn't mean to necessarily present staff influence as being a bad thing. What I was proposing is where you have someone who has taken on the chairmanship of some incredibly important thing without really any subject matter expertise and being so totally divorced from the chair, the committee that they run, that they really are managed by staff. So staff expertise, yes, that can be good. And obviously there's a lot of institutional knowledge that they carry. But my concern was when people take a committee because of, you know, fundraising potential as opposed to having any interest or expertise.
Quick follow-up?
Or investment potential where you can start playing the markets because, I mean, this has happened. It's a real thing. Yeah. And I just wanted to ask if you know, I grew up in Iowa and Chuck Grassley was the senator when I was a kid. So how many years has he been in?
So Grassley is now the longest serving senator in American history. I believe he's just over 51 years in present. We actually were looking at the numbers earlier. He has actually been there. There have been 2018 U.S. senators. So Ashley Moody, who was appointed in Florida, is the 2018 senator. Chuck Grassley was the 1700 and I think 43rd or 53rd. So he has actually seen 275 U.S. senators come and go while he has been in the United States Senate. So it's some remarkable statistics.
Okay.
I think his vacuum cleaner is older than I am. He's always tweeting about how his old Betty or Betsy is his vacuum cleaner, who's, I think, my age.
He's a character. Thank you.
Vice Chair Story? Well, I put myself in the queue too. I guess I really appreciate the presentation, and I think talking about Senator Grassley is just the perfect example for where term limits are supported by a lot of voters, by a lot of Alaskans. At the same time, I share a lot of the concerns that Representative Himshue pointed out, mainly that we're public figures, and so we are ultimately accountable to the public we serve. And when that expertise is transferred more towards staff who will then potentially have, you know, 40, 50, 60 year careers in Washington, D.C., that those folks are a little bit less accountable to the public. Most people don't even know who they are. Do you have any, we talked about it a little bit, but do you have any specific response to that concern?
Madam Chairman, Madam Chair, Costine again with U.S. Term Limits. I do, and it's kind of in two parts. The first is that sort of a disagreement on the idea that they're accountable. You are accountable to your voters. There is nothing that prevents somebody from filing and giving you a good run for your money in your district. It doesn't take $10 million. It doesn't take outside mail. Like, it's doable. And most lawmakers at the state level are similarly in touch with their district. You go home to your district. You're shopping at the same grocery stores. You don't disconnect the way they do. They're not accountable. They can be absolutely – this is the world's most unpopular group of elected officials who cannot be beaten in a popularity contest. Okay, so the system is broken, and we can see that. The re-election rates for people is as unpopular as they are. Mitch McConnell in Kentucky was not beloved by Kentucky. But no Republican would dare run against him, and they weren't going to vote for the Democrat in the general election. And so Mitch McConnell got to have that seat for as long as he did. And I guarantee he did not feel that he was accountable to the people of Kentucky. We have a senator in Arizona whose prime residence on his mortgage documents is in Virginia. Now, beyond the legal questions that raises, his wife and kids are in Virginia. They go to Virginia schools. He spends his time in Virginia, and he comes home to Arizona to campaign. So the account of, I feel like you're accountable in a way that perhaps they're not. Regarding the staff expertise question, we're not eliminating institutional knowledge from the bodies, from Congress. There will be some staggered. You'll have people that are new. You'll have people that have been there for a while. And they get to hire or fire staff. So staff isn't necessarily eternal unless they're really good. That's in theory. Because if you're doing a good job, they keep you on a staff. And if you don't, you probably go off to the private sector where you can make even more money. And then you start lobbying the staff. But I think that system survives. Our problem right now is that voters don't really have legitimate options in most races because there's one item on the menu. You don't have the fresh ideas. You'll see a lot of people that are there for two or three terms and they quit because they went to make a difference. They realize they can't because the guy who's been there 28 years has all the power. And they just quit and they go home. And so the people we send to Congress are the people who are willing to wait 20 years to start doing something. The problem is that after you've waited 20 years and you start to do your thing, might have been a good idea 20 years ago, but is it still a good idea today? Or have you just waited 20 years and now it's your turn? Like, there's just a lot of problems that we're trying to fix kind of all at once with this. So I think quality staff survives. I think you probably see that. I don't know, but I assume you probably see that around here. At least Connor. I would say Connor. The lawmakers talk. You guys talk to each other about staff. You know who's good, you know, and they're likely to stay as long as they want to stay. So, and I think staff and the members can work well together. The problem is that the members, this was never to be a career. This job did not pay. Going to Congress, there was a per diem when they were in session, but going to Congress did not pay. You didn't go to Congress to get rich. And as Representative Himshue pointed out, there's some members of Congress doing really well in office now. So we've gotten so far from how it was supposed to run that, of course, it's not working well. And it's ultimately going to be up to the states to force Congress to fix that. And that's – and this is that only path, which is why we're here. Sorry for the filibuster. That was in honor of the Senate.
No, I really appreciate the thorough engagement on it. And it is something very much worth taking seriously and thinking about. I guess I do still have some concerns. You know, I wonder some of the things you mentioned, if we might solve some of the challenges with incumbency through stricter campaign finance laws. And we talked ad nauseum in this committee about elections reform for the state last year. One of the things we didn't address in our elections bill that still needs to be addressed in Alaska is independent expenditure campaigns. And the money and politics component of this is so critical. And there's no question that incumbents have an advantage in a huge way in that capacity. But I also just wonder if there's a lot of other avenues that help address the underlying issue of basically our Congress acting like a retirement home for a lot of folks. And we don't want that. I think there's a lot of broad acknowledgement for that. So I really appreciate the dialogue. And the other just comment I had is regarding longtime incumbency and the potential for these more subject matter experts to get elected to the legislature and then be firebrands and work really well across the aisle and just work really well in general is something that I think is at a state level kind of close to home for a lot of us in this room, because the sponsor of this resolution and two of the people at this table got elected together in the largest freshman class in the state's history. But because so much of positions are based on seniority, you know, we have people in this room who didn't have an opportunity because of that dynamic to hop into higher level leadership roles right out the gate. And maybe that's not the right way to approach some of our processes. So I really appreciate the dialogue. I'm also filibustering, but
this is your committee. I appreciate, if I would add a final point, Madam Chair, it's compare the energy that comes to a race with an open seat, which you don't get a lot of up here. But in most states, you have an incumbent. Maybe they get a challenger. It's usually not a real challenger, not a serious challenger. They don't take it all that seriously, not cover it all that seriously, or an open seat, even if it's a safe district, competitive district, where suddenly there's 6, 8, 10, 12 people all running earnestly for that seat with competing ideas and trying to build coalitions. And I mean, they're engaging the voters and they're working turnout, and that's healthy. I mean, that's democracy, how it's supposed to be. And that's something that you see in open seats, but you almost never see, you know, once the seat is filled. And that's kind of the healthy, vital democracy we're trying to get back to. So I appreciate that.
I think we have time for just a couple more questions, Representative Himshute.
Yeah, I don't want to throw a bomb here too much, but through the chair, some of the ballot box issues you're talking about are resolved through open primaries or not. If you open the primary, and then if you couple that with ranked choice, not throwing a bomb here, but if you do that, then people have more options, more choices, and they're not held back by, well, here's McConnell and he's unbeatable and I'm not going to try. He becomes beatable.
Madam Chair, Representative Hibshute, because the ranked choice is a fairly new experiment on the national level,
Australia.
We'd have, understood. The disparity in fundraising, name ID, the institutional advantage, the ability to frank your communication and have the taxpayers basically pay for the newsletters and the radio ads and everything, it is still such a lopsided effort. I spent a lot of my time actually on the campaign side of things. And so I'm very aware of sort of why people just don't even bother. I mean, at the end of the day, it still has to be the person who can get to 50% plus one under a rank system. If it's not a race system, a plurality can win most of these races and oftentimes does. And so you'll find that the incumbent is still the one 9 times out of 10 or 95 times out of 100 best able to win those races. We can talk campaign finance report. We can talk ballot box reform. We can talk a lot of these things. We're also in the realm of possibilities. What changes can you make right now that could survive Supreme Court challenges, that could survive whatever? This one's simple because this one becomes the Constitution. And this is something that has, again, that 80%+ support nationwide. Even if you have an idea on campaign finance and you could get Congress to propose it, could you get 38 states to ratify it? like in the realm of possibility, what can we do that would fix a bunch of problems that we can actually accomplish? And that's what makes this one so unique, because you're not going to have a problem finding 38 states to ratify this. I mean, 50 states will ratify this. There's not a state where this thing isn't insanely popular. I'm a yes on trying all sorts of things, but this is the one that can get that can happen and quickly, and then we can see what other changes need to be made. And we should never stop trying to improve. But I don't, you know, the fact that we have other good ideas, hopefully this one still gets to be a really good idea.
Thanks.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you. Do we have any additional questions from the committee, Representative McCabe?
Thanks. Yeah, I won't respond to the bomb thrower much as I would like to.
It's
I could
Saturday.
Talk for hours, but I won't. But I am excited to hear that you're interested in campaign finance reform, Madam Chair, because I happen to have a bill for that we should hear pretty quickly then. Unfortunately, it's not going to be able to address Citizens United. That's going to have to go through the courts. But I understand your frustration. I share it. So I'm a member of Term Limits USA. So I'll disclose that right now. I firmly believe that we have to go that way. Somehow we have to stop the retirement home sort of thing. I have thought a lot about this staff issue. And at the end of the day, if, as an elected official, I'm responsible for the staff. And it's our job, I think, as voters to elect somebody that can control the staff, that's not going to be controlled by the staff, if that makes sense. So it's a leadership thing, right? And that's, we're supposed to be electing leaders that can manage a staff of 10, 15, however many they have, and not be managed by their staff. So it was early on, I looked pretty seriously into that, thinking, well, you know, we don't want to have a government run by unelected staffers, but I don't think that'll be the case. I really don't. So just my turn to filibuster. I couldn't not talk after the bomb was thrown.
Do we have any additional Representative Vance?
Oh, wow. By all means, I think they've just been passed it. She just passed the baton, right? No, I fully support this. I've co-sponsored everyone that's come through, and I'm feeling embarrassed that my name's not on this yet, but it will be. I look at this at how our founders looked at governance, and our very first president soon recognized that staying in office for extended amount of time was not healthy for our government. It wasn't healthy for the individual. And so he chose, he was begged, we want you to run again. We want you to, and he felt that it was moving towards being a king. And so I think that's how we need to look at this. The very simplistic nature of what our founding fathers were looking at about what true representation meant. And we've missed that. And it's not complicated. I think that's why it's so popular among the people, is that they're saying, hey, you know, the founders of our nation who saw, they were visionaries, and they didn't think of everything that we face, but I am amazed at the wisdom that they had and the reflections that we can look back on. And this is that. It's that simple. That this levels the playing field. It sets us on equal footing and really encourages more people to participate in self-governance. I'm trying to encourage people to do that all the time on every level, right? We try to get people to do that, but one of the discouraging factors is that they feel like they can't ever get into the race. And it takes a lot to overcome those who have been entrenched in the system, because they know all the tricks of the trade. So I hope that this committee looks at it at its very, very simple foundation of our founding fathers. They recognize that. I forget who the other president was, that it aged. You can look at the presidents who run two terms. It ages them significantly. I can contend that, you know, myself, this, what we do and the weight that we carry for the big decisions is impactful. And I think having a fresh perspective is very, very healthy. But the 12-year term limits allows you to kind of get your feet on the ground and understand how to balance and weigh some of the issues well, and help the new people along. So I don't think it's too short. I think it's a respectful amount of time that we can get some really good policies. So I'm in support of this on the very foundation of leveling the playing field, but also getting back to what our founding fathers envisioned for our country.
Thank you. Any other comments or questions today? Seeing none, thank you to Mr. Queirat. Okay, great. Third time's the charm. And Mr. Mariner, and then also to Representative Tomaszewski for bringing House Joint Resolution 22 forward. We are setting House Joint Resolution 22 aside, and we're going to move to our next item on the agenda. We'll take a very brief at ease in case there's a presentation to set up. At ease. House State Affairs is back on the record, and next on the agenda, we have House Joint Resolution 23, which is a constitutional amendment relating to the governor's budget from Representative Underwood. This is our first hearing on this resolution, and today we have an introduction and presentation from the sponsor, and then we do have public testimony notice today as well. So with that, please introduce yourself for the record and begin your presentation.
Thank you, Chair Carrick and members of the committee. I promise I will not be filibustering on this sunny Saturday. Hopefully I'll make this real quick for you. For the record, I'm Representative Jubilee Underwood, sponsor of House Joint Resolution 23. I'm joined today by my staff, Buddy Witt, who will be assisting with the presentation and available for questions. HJR 23 proposes a constitutional amendment focused on the structure of Alaska's budget process. This resolution does not set spending levels. It does not eliminate programs. It does not raise revenue. Instead, it addresses how the process begins. Under Article 9, Section 12 of the Alaska Constitution, the governor is required to submit a budget and accompanying appropriation and revenue bills. Over time, statute has added structure and mechanics to that requirement. But the core constitutional obligation remains broad. HJR 23 asks whether Alaska would benefit from strengthening certain structural elements of the budget process at the constitutional level, ensuring that the legislature begin its work from a clearly defined and principled framework. This resolution does not remove legislative authority. It does not eliminate the governor's constitutional role. It simply places before the voters the question of whether our fiscal framework should be clarified and strengthened. At its core, HJR 23 is about institutional design and long-term stability. It is not about a single administration or a single fiscal year. It's about improving the structure that will govern every budget going forward. Thank you, Madam Chair. We have a short slideshow that we're going to walk through for our current constitutional and statutory guidance governing the submission of a budget to the legislature and to explain structurally what HJR 23 would do within that framework. And I'll turn it over to my staff, Buddy Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Witt.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the State Affairs Committee. For the record, my name is Buddy Witt, and I'm staff to Representative Jubilee Underwood. Madam Chair, the resolution before you and your committee is fairly elementary and simple. And so what we've done in this slideshow is to give, mostly for those who may be watching and interested in this, what the current statutory and constitutional framework and guidelines are for the budget process, and concentrating specifically on that initial budget that is released every December 15th. So first I want to start looking, and I'll go through these very quickly because, as I said, I believe it's something that both you and the members here already know. But as we know, the constitutional requirements are set out in Article 9, Section 12, and it says that the governor must submit a budget for the next fiscal year. It includes all proposed expenditures. It includes all anticipated income. The governor has to submit a general appropriation bill, submit revenue bills for new or additional revenue. Yes, that's in the Constitution, and submit a and the governor must submit those documents at the time fixed by law. So let's look to the law. So then we look at, as we all know, the Alaska Budget Act is found in Alaska Statute 37.07. In 37.07.020 subsection A, it says the budget must be released publicly by December 15th, must be translated to the legislature on December 15th, and any bills, i.e. the appropriation bills or any other revenue bills, must be delivered before the fourth legislative day. And just as a point of clarification, the bills delivered before the fourth legislative day, the revenue bills delivered before the fourth legislative day would be any revenue bills whose revenue is accounted for within the governor's budget that he submits. So it is our interpretation that those specific revenue bills, if that revenue was included in anticipated revenue for the budget, has to be delivered by the fourth legislative day as well. And that's how we operate, and we know that. The bills are required to be separate. So we have a separate mental health appropriation bill. We have a separate operating capital bill, and we'll have separate revenue measures. That's found in AS 3707020A as well. The balanced budget is required in statute. AS 3707020 subsection C. That's already in statute. We'll talk about this a little bit more. Long-range planning is a necessity described in the Alaska Budget Act. AS 3707020 subsection B says governor must have a 6-year capital improvements program and also a 10-year fiscal plan projections. Again, so the executive branch is always looking forward, anticipating expenses, changes in expenses, etc. There's format and supporting information. We have to have expenditures separated by agency. We have to have program objectives, prior year comparisons, and all the supporting financial data that we normally get, which is all things that we are currently doing. And of course, there are carved outs for amendments and supplemental budgets, as we know very well from this past week. And that is already accounted for within statute. So what does HJR 23 effectively do? How does it fit in with all of this? And Madam Chair, we submitted some legislative research going back to 2017. Gives you a broad look at what those initial budget offerings from the executive have looked like each year as it relates to deficits. You can look at that. What HJR 23 does is it basically says, yes, the governor must submit a balanced budget, and those expenditures in that budget may not exceed the anticipated revenue. But the big thing that it does, it says that anticipated revenue cannot include the CBR. In closing, the current system begins with numbers. The bill sponsor believes that it should begin with a plan. HJR 23 asks the legislature to lead and the people to decide whether a stronger constitutional structure will improve fiscal discipline. A yes vote moves Alaska forward. Predictability, accountability, and long-term planning are all things that the bill sponsor believes would happen if we make this slight little change that says we are not going to start our budget process by simply stating that there's a problem. We're going to start our budget process by at least starting with some sort of a solution so that when the legislature begins, they can consider that solution and then make ultimately whatever decision as appropriators the legislature is going to make. HJR 23 does not dictate policy as far as budget policy, fiscal policy, PFD policy, etc. It does strengthen the framework within which the policy is made. Thank you. We ask that you support the passage of HJR 23 and that you move it out of your committee as soon as possible. And we do thank you for already enlisting it next week under bills previously heard. And we are available to take any questions you may have.
Great. Thank you. Thanks for the great introductory presentation. Do we have initial questions for the bill sponsor and staff, Representative St. Clair?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the chair, Mr. Witt and Representative Underwood. My question is we have to make sure that expenditures don't exceed revenue. What sources are we using as the revenue? Because you have legislative finance that interprets a budget one way and OMB that interprets it a different way. So which one of those are we going to go with?
Through the chair, Representative St. Clair, I can't answer that question because this particular piece of legislation does not attempt to answer that question. It does not dig into the details and get into the weeds on administratively where we're taking numbers from and things like that. The executive branch, whoever the governor is in the time, and I'll add that this bill would not apply to our current governor, and we don't know who the next governor is going to be. So this is really a neutral bill politically. What this bill does is say, whatever administratively you are going to use to develop your budget, that does not conflict with the constitutional statutory provisions that we already have, that's fine. The budget just has to balance, and you can't use the CBR. The details of that, I can't answer that. That would be in the future. Should the Alaska pass this, that would be something that would come much later, and I don't have a crystal ball.
Okay, thank you.
I had put myself in the queue as well. I think that question just got answered, though, so I might come back. Is there any other questions from committee members? Representative Vance.
Thank you. I'm looking at the additional charts that you've provided, and I appreciate the one that it talks about it shows the budgets, the revenues, appropriations, and the deficit over from 2017 to 26. And I'm wondering why the supplemental budget is not listed here, or was it? I see you've listed the bill numbers. I think this is very helpful to see the past 9 years, worth of budget numbers on one page, and where we're at as a state and why this is important. It feels like we know that our supplemental budget has grown significantly this year, and how would this amendment impact the supplemental budget? Because it feels like a governor could game the system, if you will, and introduce a balanced budget in the operating and then put in a huge supplemental. And I think that moves away from the intent of the supplemental being like an emergency. Hey, there was this unforeseen event that we need funds for now. How would HCR 23 help curb that? And can it?
Through the chair, Representative Vance. To answer your question, I have to try to imagine the impacts of this going forward. It's the bill sponsor's intent that the bill would help to lower supplemental budgets, right? Because if you go into it and you're actually going to start in on a fiscal plan because you're constitutionally obligated to, then the hope is that at the end of that process, you get into a cycle that has you getting more accurate on your expenditures and more accurate on your revenues and not having to have nine-figure supplemental bills. I mean, that's the hope. I certainly can't guarantee that. As far as the information, the supplemental not being on here, we concentrated specifically on the governor's initial offering. Knowing that supplemental budgets continue to be a point of consternation for the legislature for quite some time. The thought was maybe there was something that we could do. But unfortunately, and we'll talk more about this once it gets over to judiciary, but you get into whether or not something is an amendment or not an amendment. So once you start adding more, there's already a budget structure. By adding on to that, we keep it an amendment instead of a revision. If we start adding things that aren't in the budget, such as supplemental is not mentioned in our constitution, then we start talking about revisions. So trying to keep this very tight. So that would be my answer to that.
Thank you. Thank you for the question. Through the chair, Jubilee Underwood, again, for the record, to Representative Vance. I think just starting not at a deficit, like that is exactly what my staff buddy Witt is saying clearly is just getting us to start from not a giant deficit and have a really good starting point. That is the whole intent behind this. And then obviously you can't tie future legislatures to do whatever they're going to do with their budgets and their appropriation or the governor, whatnot, but just starting at a simple not deficit and working off there, I just think is fiscally responsible. And that's the intent behind it.
Thank you.
I have a couple more questions, Representative McCabe, and then Vice Chair Story.
Thanks. Yeah, so I'm just wondering, through the chair, this would be on this coming, if everything went smooth, it would be on November's ballot for the voters. That's your vision.
Through the chair, Representative McCabe, thank you for that. That would be the hope, yes. If it gets through on time, this would be on 2026 ballot for our next go-around.
Thanks, and just a follow-up comment.
Follow-up.
So since our Constitution was ratified, 28 ballot measures have been presented to voters, and 12 have been rejected. The last one that was passed was 22 years ago. So just want to put that on the record for anybody that might happen to be watching this on a beautiful Saturday when we should be outside.
I sensed a comment in there.
No.
Vice Chair Story.
Thank you, Chair Carrick, through the chair. Thank you both for the presentation. And I had a couple of one question, and I might have missed it in your presentation, but it would help clarify it for me. Is the long range plan also supposed to be balanced in the budget? I feel the governor presents a long range plan, the 10-year plan lookout, and I'm wondering if the requirement also includes that. And then my other question was, do other states require their governors to present a balanced budget and any bills with them, to revenue bills, to make sure that balance, that budget comes to fruition? Thank you.
Thank you. Through the chair, Buddy Witt, for the record. Through the chair, Representative Story, that's a great question about the other states. I'm going to have to get that information, and then I will email it to the chair for distribution to the committee. As far as the – can you repeat your other question, please? I'm sorry.
Sure. Through the chair. Thank you. Yes, the governor presents a long-range plan, the 10-year plan, and I didn't know if you went over that, and I just missed that. Thank you.
Thank you, through the chair. Thank you. Sorry about that, Representative Story. So, yes, I included a slide that mentioned those two long-range plans. There's a 6 and 10-year plan. That, of course, is a statutory requirement. This particular piece of legislation does not touch on that, and it does not lay out any requirement for those numbers to look like anything. Again, because this is an amendment and we want to keep it from being regarded as a revision or be litigated, we're keeping it confined to what is already the Constitution, a subject matter the Constitution already discusses.
Thank you.
Thank you. And I had put myself back in the queue. So I guess I'm unfamiliar with this. Currently, if the governor wanted to submit, currently the governor can submit a deficit budget. They're not supposed to, in general practice, but they can, so long as they provide revenue measures to fill that deficit for that current year. That's what is currently the direction.
Through the chair, to the chair. Yes, that's my reading of both the statutory and constitutional guidelines, is that if there is within the once you go through, I look at it, the provisions of the Constitution, the way the sentence is structured is a laid out step-by-step process. You know your expenditures, you find out your revenues, and you offer revenue bills if there's a difference there, right? So yes, to answer your question, my understanding is that there are supposed to be revenue bills if needed.
And those are supposed to cover that current year's deficit. So like, for example, the current administration has proposed components of fiscal planning, but they don't affect this year's budget, which was provided at a deficit. And so my follow-up question would be, have we ever had, to your knowledge, an administration that has submitted a deficit budget with revenue measures that impact that year's deficit? And I guess I'm just not familiar if there have been administrations prior to our current that have submitted deficit budgets before, and if they've followed what the practice is theoretically supposed to include.
Thank you to the chair. I don't have that information, but I will get it.
Okay. Yeah. Representative Hemshoot.
Thank you, Chair Carrick. Through the chair, I've never served on a local school board. I have served not even a full term on my local assembly. This seat opened while I was in my first term. But what I remember on the assembly budget is the administrator would give us a budget and it would be balanced, but the opportunity cost would be illustrated. So yes, we can balance the budget this year, but these are the things we can't do. And this is what we're going to have to do in the enterprise funds and that kind of thing. And so I'm just trying to think about other levels of government and what they're required to do. And again, our administrator gave us a balanced budget, but made very clear, here's what it's going to take to make this happen unless we, you know, increase sales taxes or whatever. So I guess I'm just looking to you guys. Is this generally how it's done, that whatever administrative level is writing the budget must provide a balanced budget? Or is it common practice to, like on a school board or something, we always know what the gap is, right? Here's the money we have. Here's what things will cost next year. And here's the gap between those two things. So the school board doesn't necessarily begin with a balanced budget. They get a budget that says, you know, we're going to have to figure out what to cut. And I guess it's kind of what we did at the assembly as well. We were given a balanced budget, but these were the things we'd have to cut to make that happen. So I guess I'm just looking at other levels of governance and whether they start with a balanced budget like you're suggesting.
Okay. Thank you for that question. Through the chair, Representative Hemshoot, from my experience from being on the school board, it was the same thing. We did like three different projections on what it could be because we were building our budget backwards, not knowing exactly what the count was going to be. And so we would do the very poor projection, the median range, and then if everything was all great, what our high could be. But it was still having to submit. Usually we started at the lowest and then we'd know what the cuts were going to be, but we kind of built our budget backwards for the funding and the way that the mechanism went for that. So at the end of the day, though, I still had to be balanced. So, but we knew like who basically what was going to be on the chopping block and what was going to be cut. We had to make those decisions up front beforehand. That's just my experience from our school board. I haven't served on any other bodies. So that's the most knowledge I have on that one.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. I think at this time, let's go ahead and take public testimony since it was noticed today. So at this time, I'm going to open public testimony on House Joint Resolution 23. Sorry, that was, I'm doing bad with the gavel today. And is there, I don't see anybody in the room who would testify on House Joint Resolution 23. So we'll turn to online and we'll start with Larissa Fonov from Wasilla.
Hi there. Hi there. Good almost evening. Chair Carrick and members of House State Affairs Committee. For the record, my name is Larissa Fonov and I live in Wasilla, Alaska. I'm calling in support of House Joint Resolution 23. I believe a constitutional requirement to start the annual budget process with a budget that balances without draining our savings will ensure a more stable fiscal future. I fully support HJR 23. And ask you to pass it out of your committee as quickly as possible. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Ms. Fonov. And we'll turn now to Ed Martin in, it says Hilo, Hawaii, but I know that's not where you're actually from.
It's where he's at.
It's where you're at. The winter. Welcome back, Mr. Martin.
Well, thank you to allow me to speak. My name is Ed Martin, Jr. I reside in Kenai, Alaska.
That's right.
I've emailed you my public comment. I do not support this constitutional amendment for several reasons. First off, as far as I'm concerned, we're not focusing on what's really happening with our state. We're becoming dependent on additional money out of the CBR. And we're, whether the governor includes it or the legislature uses it, for all intents and purposes, it is lawful, no doubt. But what we should be concentrating is why Alaska structurally is dependent on savings instead of productive internal revenue. Now, What I added to my testimony is something that I have submitted to the Permanent Fund trustees for the meeting on Monday, and I hope many of you representatives and the Senate sort of witness what will happen at that particular quarterly meeting and whether or not they'll accept an offer of ideas from just a plain citizen who has never took an oath to office. But I can tell you that we need to change the perspective of how Alaska looks at being independent and sovereign and using our resources, which is, includes the permanent fund, in advancing our utilization of our resources and the manpower we have. I forwarded to you is a substitution to any constitutional amendments. I do have one offered up on the permanent fund dividend, although that's a different subject matter. But to be honest with you, everything that you do here to change the Constitution, I would think very seriously about what you're doing. And as far as the conversation about the supplemental budget, the governor has no clue what's going to happen into the crystal ball, even though he looks in there, maybe on occasion, hoping all be rosy. But the plain and simple fact is, what you really should be focusing on is what I just provided to you and what happened with our past revenue commissioner and the $50 million that has been taken out of the CBR. That's the focus you should be making right now. Where is the money going and where is it coming from? I gave you a solution that will help Alaska into the future. Please look at it and read it wisely. Any questions, you can call me. So God bless you all in your mission, but I don't support this particular resolution. Thank you for my opportunity to speak.
Thank you, Mr. Martin. And I also just heard it's your birthday on Monday. So happy birthday on Monday.
Thank you very much.
And thank you to Rep. Hemshute for pointing that out to me. All right. We'll go now to Ryan Sheldon in Talkeetna.
Hey there, everyone. Good to see. I was observing today. So good to see all the friendly faces there. And just wanted to call in support of Representative Underwood and HDR 23. I won't belabor my point, but as a businessman, at least, seems like a pretty common sense thing to operate within the margins of what your expected income is going to be for a fiscal year, as opposed to planning on, you know, using any other maybe savings or any day accounts would be it. But just wanted to call in and say I'm supporting Representative Underwood on this, and I hope that you all pass it. I see that there's great bipartisan support on this, which is healthy as usual, and I'm looking forward to seeing this hit the House floor soon if it's the will of the committee. So anyway, thanks again, and hope to see you all sometime soon here, and good to see you all, and thanks for hearing me out.
Thank you, Mr. Sheldon. And that concludes our public testimony for everybody online and in the room. So we will close public testimony on HJR 23. And the resolution is back before the committee. Do we have any additional questions or discussion on this? Seeing none, we're going to set House Joint Resolution 23 aside for today. And we will be bringing it back up on Tuesday. So just want to thank Representative Underwood and her staff for presenting it today. Thank you. Okay, and last but certainly not least, we have two related items on our agenda, House Bill 290 and House Concurrent Resolution 10. They both relate to distribution of resolutions passed by the legislature, and both are sponsored by Representative Holland. So with the sponsors' indulgence, we are going to kind of overlap discussion on these two items today. And it's my understanding that our bill sponsor's staff is going to present both simultaneously. We do have public testimony listed on both, so we will open and close public testimony separately for each. after the initial presentation. So before going into the introduction, I'm going to turn it to Representative Holland, who has joined us by phone today, to see if he has opening remarks. Representative Holland.
Good afternoon, Chair Carrick and committee. This is Kai. I had a prior excused trip arranged this weekend, so I apologize for not being there in person when I realized that this was going to be scheduled under this trip. So I'm remote and have a marginal connection and just want to acknowledge the opportunity for the bill to be presented and the work that my staff, Aiden Nickel, will do to be able to present this. I will attempt to be available if there are any questions. I would just note that these two actions together relate to the timely transmission of joint resolutions that are passed by the legislature, whether they're a House joint resolution or a Senate joint resolution. Our current uniform rules and the current duties of the executive do not have any specific time frame on when these resolutions are fully transmitted. And in some cases, I learned last session, we were acting on fairly urgent items. For example, the spring wildfire danger. And I was surprised to learn that these resolutions, all of them, were allowed to sit for some time into the summer and only transmitted in the fall. So thank you again for hearing these two. One a bill, one a resolution. I'll be standing by and try to be available if there are questions. I appreciate my staff and the indulgence of the committee to take these two items up today.
Thank you, Representative Holland. And if you do want to just stay on the line, if there's questions directly for you, we'll do our best to get them to you. I'd like to welcome Aiden Nickel, staff to Representative Holland Ford, to go ahead and present both House Bill 290 and House Concurrent Resolution 10.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Aiden Nickel, staff to Representative Holland. As the representative said, we are presenting today on a pair of measures aimed at streamlining the process by which resolutions are sent out to their designated recipients. The original impetus for this legislation was a resolution passed by Representative Holland at the end of last session, HJR 15, recommending preparations for what we knew would be an unusually severe wildfire season. Last fall, it came to the representative's attention that the Anchorage Mayor's Office did not receive their copy of this resolution until October 6th, after the conclusion of the wildfire season. And as we dug further into this problem, we learned that all of the resolutions passed last session, even those addressing active debates in Congress, were sent out on a severely delayed timeframe. So these two measures aim to address that delay. These are separate pieces of legislation because the issue involves both the internal affairs of the legislature, which requires a change to uniform rules through a concurrent resolution, and governing the actions of the executive branch, which requires legislation. House Concurrent Resolution 10 changes uniform rules to reassign responsibility for distribution of resolutions to the House Clerk and Senate Secretary. And House Bill 290 establishes a timeline for resolutions to pass through the governor's office. And before going further, I want to make sure that we establish a solid understanding of the resolution process as it exists now. This process is largely set by Rule 49 of the Uniform Rules, which, Madam Chair, you can find a copy of in your bill packet. Currently, the Office of the Governor receives all resolutions as a matter of information, but only joint resolutions receive the governor's signature. Once the governor signs a joint resolution, it is transmitted to the Lieutenant Governor's office, and she is responsible for distributing it to the specified recipients. For all other resolutions, the Legislative Affairs Agency is given the responsibility of distribution. Importantly, there are no deadlines set for any of these steps, unlike for bills, which the governor is required under the Constitution to sign within 15 days or within 20 days outside of session. Largely because it requires the participation of so many different entities, all of whom are tasked with other critical duties, this process has ceased to function smoothly, especially for joint resolutions. The Lieutenant Governor's office is so far removed from the sponsor of a resolution that the urgency with which it was passed can get lost in translation. It can be difficult for the sponsoring office to track the resolution as it progresses through the executive branch, and in many cases, the sponsor doesn't know where in the process the resolution lies. And that means that if a constituent who has been advocating for a resolution reaches out to its sponsor and says, "Has this made it to the congressional delegation yet?" the constituent may not be able to get an answer. But the most significant problem that this process results in is delays. Last session, all of the joint resolutions that were passed were sent out between September 29th and October 3rd. This includes HJR 5, which addressed an active debate in Congress about reinstating rural school funding, and HJR 4, which was a swift response to the renaming of Denali. Both of these issues were live debates in Washington in February, and neither of these resolutions reached our congressional delegation until the fall. That's a serious issue, both because it limits the legislature's ability to speak on important national issues, and because it diminishes our state's credibility on a national stage. The bill and the resolution each contain just one section. HB 290 states that the governor is required to return resolutions to the LAA within 15 days of their transmittal to him, or within 20 days if the legislature is not in session. Excuse me. As I mentioned earlier, this is the same time frame as the Constitution requires for bills. This measure does not speak at all directly to the governor's signature. He or she is still free to sign or leave unsigned a resolution so long as it is returned on time. The concurrent resolution, HCR 10, amends Uniform Rule 49 so that the clerk and secretary are responsible for the distribution of all resolutions. This moves joint resolutions over from the lieutenant governor's office and all other resolutions over from the LAA. The goal of the move for joint resolutions is to place them in an office that is closer to the workings of the legislature so that there can be better communication as they're processed. As for other resolutions, it is our understanding that it is already the clerk and secretary who take on the burden of distributing those. So in that area, we're just aligning uniform rules with the current de facto process. This section also puts a timeline on distribution by the clerk and secretary. It requires them to send out resolutions within 15 days of transmittal to them. And it requires that they notify a resolution sponsor when it is sent to recipients. And with that, Madam Chair, I welcome the committee's questions.
Great. I know we have a couple. Representative McCabe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So two things. First is a question. Do we know on the resolutions that you said got kind of hung up, where were they hung up? Were they hung up in the governor's office or were they hung up in the legislature?
That's a good question through the chair, Representative McCabe. We saw delays in both. We saw a significant delay in the governor's office and then another significant delay in the lieutenant governor's office.
Follow up. How about in the legislature? I mean, I know that we held one bill last year until November. We did that. The legislature did that. So how about an amendment, since this is the only committee referral for both of these? How about an amendment to include that it needs to be transmitted out of the legislature to the governor in a timely fashion, whether it be the same 15 days or, would that be okay with you? That might be a Kai question.
Through the chair, Representative McCabe, I can absolutely let my boss speak to that. I will say the delays that we saw for the resolutions making it from the Legislative Affairs Agency to the office of the governor were generally much shorter in duration. It was usually about 2 to 3 weeks. However, that can change given the dynamics within the LAA. So I think that would be a reasonable amendment if we're committed to keeping this process streamlined.
Yeah, thanks. I don't think it was LAA that held up the tax bill. I think it was us.
Okay. I have a couple of folks in the queue, but I want to see if Representative Holland has a response to that first question.
Great. Thanks. I'd be happy to look into it. You know, I do know that there was a great deal of variation in all of the joint resolutions, and we can do a little bit of digging into kind of tracking that question that Representative McCabe is making in terms of when it was transmitted to the executive's office We do know from the record and basis that all of the resolutions were finally released from the executive's office, I believe, on July 16th. The amount of time that they sat in the executive office was variable depending upon whether a resolution was passed early in the session or late in the session, but they all sat together until the middle of July when they were all released at one time and then went to the Lieutenant Governor's office. But to your point, if there's perhaps a timeline to put in that initial transmittal just to provide fairness and clarity to all, I'd be happy to look at an amendment to provide that clarity also. Thanks for the question.
Perfect. Thanks.
And then we're going to go to Representative Vance, and I have a good cue going, so I think everybody's in it.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The question that I have is more on a separation of powers, and the resolutions are very different than a bill that we need to have the governor support on. So my question is, why do our resolutions need to touch the executive branch at all? What is the precedent? I'd really like to know legally what the implications are, but do you have an answer for me?
Through the chair, Representative Vance, that is an excellent question that we sought an answer to. We asked both the executive branch and the clerk and secretary in meetings with them what the reason for this step is, and neither of them had answers. But I would be happy to dig further into it and try to get your response.
Follow up. Thank you. I'd like to see, you know, how other states deal with this. If there was a jurisprudence in the reason that this exists, I feel like this is definitely touching on separation of powers, and I don't want to pull a thread that has other consequential impacts that we don't quite understand yet. I feel like there's probably more to this, but also want to protect our power as the legislature to be able to get statements out there that we make via resolution in process in a timely manner, because we seek to have alignment with the executive branch on positions that we feel passionate about, especially when we do have unanimous consent. It is something that we want to get a message to Congress, for instance, but that doesn't always happen. And yet there, I do have some consternation of automatically cutting out, it looks like it's removing the lieutenant governor, and I'd like to understand what the function of that is, and hope that maybe we could have some legal insight.
Through the chair, if I may, add a couple more comments. The role of the lieutenant governor, again, in my conversation with them, they weren't able to provide a definitive answer. They did note that Lieutenant Governor is tasked with many record-keeping duties, and so it may be related to that responsibility. They did note that they felt that this change may actually ease the legislature's relationship with the office of the Lieutenant Governor because it does produce some friction when legislators are upset with the office that their resolutions aren't being sent out on time. And you also raise the important note of the separation of powers, which is an important consideration. I would just note that Title 24 of the Alaska Statutes does place pretty significant guidelines on the way that the governor interacts with the legislative process. So it certainly wouldn't be unprecedented to make this change.
And one more
follow-up.
Thank you. This is on HCR 10, the amendment to the uniform rules. And just for clarification, any bill that we pass to change the uniform rules must be taken up by a joint session and passed by is it a majority or two-thirds?
Through the chair, two-thirds.
Thank you. And I had put myself in the queue. I had an experience 2 years ago where I had requested a bill be transmitted a bill to the governor's office, and it wasn't for, I think, 5 months after I kept requesting. So I'm just curious, why does this relate only to resolutions? Why not also relate to bills being transmitted from the legislature? Or is the intent just to kind of focus on the executive process? And I guess I see where this came from. I just wonder if internally we couldn't also do better about transmittal for all of our documents.
Madam Chair, I think that you raise an excellent point. This the scope of these measures has remained limited simply because that was the genesis of this work. And I think Representative McCabe raised the excellent point that sometimes there are delays in our process too. And I would be happy to speak with Representative Holland about perhaps making that addition.
Yeah, thank you. I guess I just a little bit echo the comments of Representative McCabe, and it doesn't necessarily affect my support for this resolution, but it just is another consideration. I'll go to Vice Chair Story, and then I have Representative Himshute.
Through the chair, thank you, Mr. Nickel, and thank you, Rep. Holland, online there. I actually really pleased to even have this information, not even being aware of the large gap, and it's concerning. So thank you for your work on that. My question has to do with bills and resolutions, because my understanding is a lot of times when we pass a bill, it has to be looked at legally and really going have conforming changes, and that can take some time, especially at the end of a session when there's several bills. It seems that they're passed several bills towards the end. We're all familiar with that. And so as you look into this, I would, you know, caution about the timeline if people are thinking about amendments when it comes to bills, keeping that in mind. But it certainly seems that this bill is in order. I think I heard you say, and this is my one question, is you did not receive an explanation for why it can take so long for a resolution to get through the offices, to get out to who we are really trying to urgently let know what we are concerned about and want to see action taken on.
Through the chair, Vice Chair Story, we did not receive an explanation from the governor's office. They were unable to offer any comment. From the lieutenant governor's office, there were a few. They walked us through the process. There were a few different procedures that did generate delays. One, of course, was them waiting for transmittal from the governor's office, and then another is simply the workload of. Often these resolutions have many, many recipients. Having to go in and find all of those addresses can be fairly time consuming. And these offices, of course, have many other duties. And sometimes in these offices, resolutions are seen as less important. And so with other pressing duties, this falls to the back of the queue.
Follow up. So, excuse me. So knowing that information, is this the correct timeline that you, the number of days that you have proposed in your bill, looking at that information, I would be interested in knowing why you picked this timeline with getting that response from the Lieutenant Governor's office.
We picked this timeline, Vice Chair Story, through the chair, in part because it aligns with the constitutional timeline, our rationale, not having received a response from the governor's office on whether that seemed realistic. Our rationale is that if it's realistic for legislation, it should also be realistic for resolutions. Again, that was without input from the governor's office. That was our best estimation. Legal services agreed that was a reasonable time frame. As far as the time frame that we are placing on the clerk and secretary, they did note that they felt that was a reasonable time frame for them to get these resolutions distributed.
Thank you,
Representative Himshute.
Through the chair, I don't know if this is the appropriate time, but I could use a quick tutorial on the types. You know, there's HR, there's HCR, and there's HJR, and which one does what. And this applies specifically to JRs, right? Is that something you can help me with?
Yes, through the chair, Representative Hemshute. So for joint resolutions, that is considered the most formal type of resolution. Those are passed by both houses and then can accept a governor's signature, although it's not required. The governor failing to sign a joint resolution does not veto it. It's simply transmitted without their signature. Those resolutions currently go through the lieutenant governor's office. All other resolutions by uniform rules are transmitted through the LAA. However, as I mentioned, in practice, that responsibility has fallen to the clerk and secretary. And so another goal of this legislation is to consolidate that process so there isn't overlap in duties, so that all of this work goes to the clerk and secretary's office, who, as I mentioned, said that their offices are prepared to absorb this workload. Does that
follow?
Yeah, thank you, through the chair. How does one decide which type of resolution one would like to file?
Through the chair, Representative Hemshute, that would depend on the representative or senator's goal with the resolution. So my understanding is that if one wishes to express their feelings about an issue of national politics, if one would like to propose an amendment either to the state or federal constitution, or perform a number of other enumerated goals, that must be done through a joint resolution. The other types of resolutions generally have very specific purposes. So this resolution here, HCR 10, is used to amend the uniform rules and other internal processes of the legislature. I do need to look at my notes here to touch on the others. There is a special concurrent resolution, which is used to express disapproval of executive actions. There is a House special resolution or Senate special resolution, which has the purpose of impeaching a member of one legislative body. And then you have a simple resolution, which is just a House resolution or Senate resolution, and that simply expresses the will of one body. Did I cover everything you were hoping to get, a representative?
Okay, and seeing no additional questions from our members, we're going to separately open public testimony on each of these two items. So first, we will open public testimony on House Bill 290. And I see no one in the room to testify. We do have one online testifier. Again, Ed Martin, welcome. And please proceed with your testimony.
Thank you very much for the welcome, Madam Chair, and other members of House Affairs. I am support, and I want to commend Kai Holland for bringing this forward. This is one of the things that a lot of people get concerned about, the bureaucracy of the legislature, where things should move along rather swiftly. And in fact, if I think it was a resolution that was so important to maybe send our troops to defend the state, it would pass through in lightning speed. So thank you, Kai, for trying to, you know, fix that in some fashion. Of course, this bill deals with the fact that there's a follow-up also, and I'll testify to that now so I don't have to hang around for the next conversation, and that is HCR 10. I'd like to remind people that last year I sent a letter to House Judiciary with a sample resolution ready to go, and it was mid-March, and it had to do with an investigation of our judiciary. You all know resolution could have, in effect, cost involved, and it could be rather significant with regards to investigation of any branch of government whatsoever. And so, you know, speedily moving this stuff along could have a big effect on how all three branches of government are responsible and accountable to our representatives, our voice. And I want to thank you all for allowing me to speak on this. But please go back to what I sent to the legislature last year. Revisit what I sent you. All it was in good faith. So God bless you all. Have a great afternoon.
Thank you, Mr. Martin. And at this time, again, seeing no further testimony online or in the room, we are going to close public testimony on House Bill 290. And we will open public testimony on House Concurrent Resolution 10. And I see nobody in the room. Online, we do just have Mr. Ed Martin. I just want to confirm, Mr. Martin, that your previous testimony is sufficient for this resolution.
Oh, thank you very much, Madam Chair. I got unmuted, but I didn't expect I'm hanging on. But once again, Kai, thank you so much for your diving into this, moving these concurrent resolution and the bill forward. It's much needed. Let's get more efficient down in the legislature. Thank you very much, Madam Chair and committee members.
Thank you, Mr. Martin. And seeing no further folks online or in the room, we will close public testimony on House Concurrent Resolution 10. And at this time, both HB 290 and House Concurrent Resolution 10 are back before us. Are there any additional questions from our committee members? I would like to offer, if he's still online, Representative Holland a chance for closing remarks for today.
Thank you, Chair Carrick, and thank you to the committee and those who have spoken. I appreciate the opportunity to bring this issue before you and the discussion we've had today, and look forward to the follow-up. Thank you.
Thank you very much, and enjoy the rest of your cabin trip this weekend. We're all there with you in spirit. Okay, so seeing no further discussion on HB 290 and HCR 10, we are setting both aside for a future hearing, and the plan is to bring them back up on Tuesday this week. With nothing else on the agenda, this concludes House State Affairs for today. I would thank everybody for being here on Saturday. We did have a couple of folks have to go, but I do want to thank everybody and our staff participation. And once again, shout out our committee aide, our LIO moderator, our clerk's office folks. It really is wonderful that you all were able to come and join us today. At our next hearing on Tuesday, February 24th at 3:15, we will hear again, House Bill 130 on flexible time credit from Rep. Josephson. We will finally have a first hearing on House Bill 278 from Rep. Costello on the Alaska-Ireland Trade Commission. And we will be bringing back up HJR 23 on a governor's balanced budget proposal from Representative Underwood, as well as both HB 290 and HCR 10 on delivery of resolutions from Representative Holland. With nothing else before the committee, we are adjourned at 4:56 p.m.